Chapter 4. Milan. Cultural Diplomat. In 1482, the year he turned 30, Leonardo da Vinci left Florence for Milan, where he would end up spending the next 17 years. Travelling with him was his companion, Atalante Migliorotti, now 15, the aspiring musician who learned from Leonardo how to play the lyre and became one of the many young men who floated in and out of his retinue over the years. Leonardo estimated in his notebook that the trip was 180 miles long, which was quite accurate. He had devised a type of odometer that measured distance by counting the turns of a vehicle wheel, and he may have experimented with one on the way. It would have taken him and his companions about a week. With him he carried a lira da braccio, lyre for the arm, roughly akin to a fiddle or violin. He was sent by Lorenzo the Magnificent, along with Atalante Migliorotti, to the Duke of Milan to present him a lyre, since he was unique in playing this instrument, the Anonimo Gaddiano reports. It was made partly of silver, and Leonardo had crafted it in the shape of a horse's skull. The lyre and Leonardo's services were a diplomatic gift. Lorenzo de' Medici, eager to navigate the swirling rivalries and alliances among the Italian city-states, saw Florence's artistic culture as a source of influence. Botticelli and some of his other favourite artists went to Rome to please the Pope, Verrocchio and others to Venice. Leonardo and Atalante were probably part of a February 1482 diplomatic delegation headed by Bernardo Rucellai, a wealthy banker, arts patron and philosophy enthusiast who was married to Lorenzo's older sister and had just been made Florence's ambassador to Milan. In his writings, Rucellai introduced the term balance of power to describe the continuous conflicts and shifting alliances involving Florence, Milan, other Italian city-states, plus a pride of popes, French kings, and Holy Roman emperors. The competition among the various rulers was not only military, but cultural, and Leonardo sought to be useful on both fronts. Packing almost all of his belongings, Leonardo embarked for Milan with the thought that he might move there indefinitely. The list he made of his possessions sometime after his arrival in Milan seems to encompass most of his work that could be transported. In addition to the drawing of Atalante with his face raised, there were sketches of many flowers copied from nature, some St. Jerome's, designs of furnaces, a head of Christ done in pen, 8 St. Sebastians, many compositions of angels, a head in profile with beautiful hair, gadgets for ships, gadgets for water, many necks of old women and heads of old men, many complete nudes, a Madonna finished, another almost finished that is in profile, the head of an old man with an enormous chin, a narrative of the Passion made in relief, and much more. The inclusion on the list of designs for furnaces and gadgets for ships and for water shows that he was already engaged with engineering as well as art. Milan, with 125,000 citizens, was 3 times the size of Florence. More important for Leonardo, it had a ruling court. The Medici in Florence were generous supporters of the arts, but they were bankers who operated behind the scenes. Milan was different. For 200 years, it had been not a merchant republic, but a city-state ruled by militaristic strongmen who crowned themselves hereditary dukes. First the heads of the Visconti family, and then the Sforza family. Because their ambitions were grand, but their claims to their titles tenuous, their castles were filled with courtiers, artists, performers, musicians, hunt masters, state crafters, animal trainers, engineers, and any other helpers or ornaments who could burnish their prestige and legitimacy. In other words, Milan's castle provided a perfect environment for Leonardo, who had a fondness for strong leaders, loved the diversity of talent they attracted, and aspired to be on a comfortable retainer. When Leonardo arrived, Milan was ruled by Ludovico Sforza, who was also 30, a dark-skinned and burly man nicknamed Il Moro, the Moor. He was not actually the Duke of Milan yet, though he exercised the authority and would soon grab the title. His father, Francesco Sforza, one of 7 illegitimate sons of a military mercenary, had seized power and made himself duke in 1450, after the Visconti dynasty dissolved. Upon his death, Ludovico's older brother became duke, but he was soon assassinated, leaving the title to his 7-year-old son. Ludovico eased aside the boy's mother as regent, thus effectively taking control of Milan in 1479. He set about beguiling and bullying his hapless nephew, usurping his powers, executing his supporters, and probably poisoning him. He officially invested himself the Duke of Milan in 1494. Ruthless in a pragmatic way, Ludovico cloaked his calculated cruelty with pretenses of courtesy, culture, and civility. Tutored by the distinguished Renaissance humanist Francesco Filelfo in painting and writing, he sought to legitimize his power and prestige along with that of Milan by attracting great scholars and artists to the Sforza court. He had long dreamed of building a massive equestrian monument to his father, partly as a way to enshrine the family's power. Unlike Florence, Milan was not well stocked with master artists. That made it more fertile territory for Leonardo. Because he was an aspiring polymath, he also enjoyed that Milan was filled with scholars and intellectuals in a wide variety of fields, partly due to the esteemed university in nearby Pavia, which was officially founded in 1361 but had roots stretching back to 825. It boasted some of Europe's best lawyers, philosophers, medical researchers, and mathematicians. Ludovico spent profligately on his personal desires, 140,000 ducats to refurbish the rooms of his palace, and 16,000 ducats for his hunting hawks, hounds, and horses, more than $19 million at 2017 gold prices. He was stingier with the intellectual and entertainment retainers in his court. His astrologer had an annual stipend of 290 ducats. High-level government officials got 150 ducats. And the artist-architect Donato Bramante, who would become Leonardo's friend, complained of getting only 62 ducats.
The job application.
It was probably soon after his arrival in Milan that Leonardo drafted the letter to Ludovico described at the beginning of this book. Some historians have supposed that he wrote the letter from Florence, but this seems unlikely. He mentioned the park adjoining Ludovico's castle and the proposed equestrian monument to his father, indications that he had already spent time in Milan before composing the letter. Leonardo did not, of course, write it in his usual mirror script. The copy that survives in his notebooks is a draft, marked up with a few changes, that was composed in the conventional left-to-right manner by a scribe or one of his assistants with good penmanship. It reads, "Most illustrious Lord, having now sufficiently studied the inventions of all those who proclaim themselves skilled contrivers of instruments of war, and having found that these instruments are no different than those in common use, I shall be bold enough to offer, with all due respect to the others, my own secrets to your excellency and to demonstrate them at your convenience. 1. I have designed extremely light and strong bridges adapted to be easily carried, and with them you may pursue and at any time flee from the enemy, and others, indestructible by fire and battle, easy to lift and place. Also, methods of burning and destroying those of the enemy. 2. I know how, during a siege, to take the water out of the trenches and make an infinite variety of bridges, covered ways, ladders, and other machines suitable to such expeditions. 3. If a place under siege cannot be reduced by bombardment, because of the height of its banks or the strength of its position, I have methods for destroying any fortress, even if it is founded upon solid rock. 4. I have kinds of cannons, convenient and easy to carry, that can fling small stones almost resembling a hailstorm, and the smoke of these will cause great terror to the enemy, to his great detriment and confusion. 9. Leonardo moved up this item in the draft. And when the fight is at sea, I have many kinds of efficient machines for offense and defense, and vessels that will resist the attack of the largest guns and powder and fumes. 5. I have ways of making, without noise, underground tunnels and secret winding passages to arrive at a desired point, even if it is necessary to pass underneath trenches or a river.
6. I will make unassailable armored chariots that can penetrate the ranks of the enemy with their artillery, and there is no body of soldiers so great that it could withstand them. And behind these, infantry could follow quite unhurt. 7. In case of need, I will make cannons and artillery of beautiful and useful design that are different from those in common use. 8. Where bombardment will not work, I can devise catapults, mangonels, caltrops, and other effective machines not in common use. 10. In times of peace, I can give perfect satisfaction and be the equal of any other in architecture and the composition of buildings, public and private, and in guiding water from one place to another. Also, I can execute sculpture in marble, bronze and clay, likewise in painting. I can do everything possible as well as any other man, whosoever he may be. Moreover, work could be undertaken on the bronze horse, which will be to the immortal glory and eternal honour of his lordship, your father, and of the illustrious house of Sforza. And if any of the above-mentioned things seem impossible or impracticable to anyone, I am most readily disposed to demonstrate them in your park or in whatsoever place shall please your excellency. Leonardo mentioned none of his paintings, nor did he refer to the talent that ostensibly caused him to be sent to Milan, an ability to design and play musical instruments. What he mainly pitched was a pretense of military engineering expertise. Partly this was to appeal to Ludovico, whose Sforza dynasty had taken power by force and was faced with the constant threat of a local revolt or French invasion. In addition, Leonardo cast himself as an engineer because he was going through one of his regular bouts of being bored or blocked by the prospect of picking up a brush. As his mood swung between melancholy and exultation, he fantasized and boasted about being an accomplished weapons designer. These boasts were aspirational. He had never been to a battle, nor actually built any of the weapons he described. All he had produced thus far were some elegant sketches of concepts for weapons, many of them more fanciful than practical. His letter to Ludovico is thus best regarded not as a reliable catalogue of his actual engineering accomplishments, but instead as a glimpse into his hopes and ambitions. Nevertheless, his boasts were not completely hollow. Had they been, he would have been easily exposed in a city where weapon design was a deadly serious endeavour. After settling into Milan, he would in fact begin to pursue military engineering earnestly and come up with some innovative concepts for machines, even as he continued to dance around the line between ingenuity and fantasy. Military engineer. While still living in Florence, Leonardo had sketched a few proposals for clever military devices. One was a mechanism for knocking down the ladders of enemy invaders trying to scale a castle wall. See figure 21 in the PDF. The defenders inside would pull large levers connected to rods that poke through holes in the wall. His drawing includes in large details showing how the rods would be attached to the levers, plus lively sketches of four soldiers pulling ropes and keeping an eye on the enemy. A related idea was for a propeller-like device that would slash away at those who made it to the top of the castle wall. Gears and shafts turned blades, like those of a helicopter, that would swing just above the wall, chopping down unfortunate soldiers trying to climb over. For when it was time to be on the offense, he designed a rolling armored siege machine that placed a covered bridge over the fortified walls of a castle. The spread of printing presses helped Leonardo pursue additional military ideas after he arrived in Milan. He borrowed some of his concepts from a book by the 13th century scientist Roger Bacon that had a list of ingenious weapons, including carts and wagons that could move without animal power, devices used to walk on water and to move underneath the water, and contrivances capable of putting man in flight, having a person placed in the center of a mechanical device with artificial wings. Leonardo embellished on all of these ideas. He also studied Roberto Valturio's On the Military Arts, a treatise filled with woodcuts of ingenious weapons. It was published in Latin in 1472 and in Italian in 1483, the year after Leonardo arrived in Milan. He bought both versions, annotated them, and struggled to improve his rudimentary Latin by making lists of the terms in the original book alongside their Italian translations. Valturio's book became a springboard for Leonardo's creativity. For example, Valturio included a drawing of a cart with rotating scythes that was rather tame. Each wheel of the clunky cart had only one small, unintimidating blade attached. With his fevered imagination, Leonardo kicked the concept up multiple notches for a fearsome scythe chariot that became one of his most famous and disconcerting pieces of military engineering. Leonardo's drawings of this scythe chariot, which he made soon after he moved to Milan, feature truly frightening whirling blades jutting out from the wheels. It also has a four-bladed spinning shaft that can project in the front or be dragged behind the chariot. He meticulously drew the connection of the gears and cogs to the shafts and wheels, creating artwork so beautiful as to be jarring. The galloping horses and the riders with their billowing capes are dazzling studies of motion, while his hatching strokes create shade and modelling worthy of a museum piece. One sheet of scythe chariot drawings is especially vivid. See figure 22. On the near side of the moving chariot, two bodies lie on the ground, their legs sliced off and the pieces scattered. On the far side, he depicts two soldiers just at the moment they are being sliced in half. Here is our gentle and beloved Leonardo, who became a vegetarian because of his fondness for all creatures, wallowing in horrifying depictions of death. It is perhaps yet another glimpse of his inner turmoil. Within his dark cave was a demon imagination. Another of his imagined but unbuilt weapons, which likewise blurs the border between practicality and fantasy, is a giant crossbow that he drew in Milan around 1485. See figure 23. The proposed machine is huge. Its armature is 80 feet across, and so is the four-wheeled carriage that would roll it onto the battlefield. To put it in perspective, he shows the weapon dwarfing a soldier who is preparing to unleash the trigger. Leonardo was a pioneer in propounding laws of proportion. How one quantity, such as force, rises in proportion to another, such as the length of a lever. A supersized crossbow should, he correctly surmised, be able to hurl projectiles that were bigger or went farther. He tried to figure out the correlation between the distance the bowstring was pulled and the force it exerted on the projectile. At first, he thought that a bowstring pulled back twice as far would exert twice the force, but he realized that rate was thrown off by the bending of the bow as the string was pulled. After various calculations, he finally concluded that the force is proportional to the angle of the string at the point where it is pulled back. Pull the string back hard, and it will make, say, a 90-degree angle. Pull back even harder, and perhaps you can get the angle down to 45 degrees. A 45-degree angle, he theorized, would deliver twice the force of 90 degrees. That doesn't turn out to be exactly right. Leonardo did not know trigonometry and thus couldn't refine the theory. But in concept, he was close. He was learning to use geometric shapes as analogues for nature's forces. In Leonardo's design, the bow was to be made with interlocking layers of wood, an early example of lamination. That would make it flexible, springy, and less likely to crack. Its string was pulled back by ropes attached to a large gear and screw mechanism, which he detailed in a side drawing. "Cocked in such a fashion," he wrote, "the device should be able to fling 100 pounds of stones." Gunpowder was in common use by then, which would seem to make a mechanical crossbow obsolete. However, if the crossbow had worked, it could have been cheaper, easier, and certainly quieter than cannons using gunpowder. As with the scythe chariot, a question arises. How serious was Leonardo? Was he merely being clever on paper and trying to impress Ludovico? Was the giant crossbow another example of his ingenuity blurring into fantasy? I believe his proposal was serious. He made more than 30 preparatory drawings, and he detailed with precision the gears, worm screws, shafts, triggers, and other mechanisms. Nevertheless, the crossbow should be classified as a work of imagination rather than invention. It was never constructed by Ludovico Sforza. When it was finally built for a television special in 2002, the contemporary engineers were unable to get it to work. During his career, Leonardo would be known for paintings, monuments, and inventions that he conceived but never brought to fruition. The giant crossbow falls into that category. That was also true, it turned out, for most of the military devices he conceived and drew during the 1480s. "I will make unassailable armored chariots," he promised in his letter to Ludovico. He did in fact design one, at least on paper. His drawing of an armored tank, which looks like a cross between a turtle and a flying saucer, shows metal plates slanted on an angle that would cause it to deflect enemy projectiles. Inside would be 8 men, some of them turning cranks to cause the tank to inch ahead, the others firing cannons that project out in all directions. There is one design flaw. A careful look at the crank and gears shows that they would turn the front wheels and the back wheels in opposite directions. Did he draw it that way intentionally, so that it could not be easily constructed without his modification? Perhaps. But the issue was moot. The machine was never built. He had also promised Ludovico, "I will make cannons and artillery of beautiful and useful design that are different from those in common use." One such attempt was a steam cannon, or architronito, an idea that Leonardo attributed to Archimedes, and that was also in Valturio's book. The concept was that the breech of a cannon would be heated in burning coals until it was super hot, then a small amount of water would be injected just behind the cannonball. If the ball was held in place for a second or so, enough steam pressure would build up to fire it a few hundred yards when released. Another proposal he drew was for a machine with many cannons, one with racks of 11 cannons each. While one set of cannons was cooling off and being reloaded, the other sets could be firing. It was the precursor to the machine gun. Only one of Leonardo's military conceptions is known to have made it off the pages of his notebooks and onto the battlefield, and he arguably deserves priority as its inventor. The wheel lock, or wheel lock, which he devised in the 1490s, was a way to create a spark for igniting the gunpowder in a musket or similar hand-carried weapon. When the trigger was pulled, a metal wheel was set spinning by a spring. As it scraped against a stone, it sparked enough heat to ignite the gunpowder. Leonardo used components of some of his previous devices, which included spring-powered wheels. One of the assistants who lived in Leonardo's household at the time was a technician and locksmith named Giulio Tedesco, known as Jules the German, who returned to Germany around 1499 and spread Leonardo's idea there. The wheel lock came into use in Italy and Germany around that time and proved to be influential in facilitating both warfare and the personal use of guns. Leonardo's wondrously imaginative giant crossbows and turtle-like tanks show his ability to let fantasy drive invention. But he had not lashed his imagination to practicality. None of his big machines would be deployed in battle by Ludovico Sforza, who did not face a serious confrontation until the French invaded Milan in 1499, at which time he fled the city. As it turned out, Leonardo would not be involved in military activity until 1502, when he went to work for a more difficult and tyrannical strongman, Cesare Borgia. The only military project Leonardo actually delivered to Ludovico was a survey of the castle's defences. He expressed approval of the thickness of the walls, but he warned that the small apertures were directly connected to secret passageways in the castle, which could permit attackers to swarm the castle if breached. While at it, he also noted the proper method for preparing the bath for Ludovico's young new wife: 4 parts of cold water to 3 parts of hot water. The ideal city. Near the end of his job application to Ludovico Sforza, Leonardo touted himself as someone who could be the equal of any other in architecture and the composition of buildings. But for his first few years in Milan, he had trouble getting any such commissions. So, for the time being, he pursued his architectural interests the way he did his military interests, mainly on paper, as imaginative visions never to be implemented. The best example was his set of plans for a utopian city, which was a favourite subject for Italian Renaissance artists and architects. Milan had been ravaged in the early 1480s by 3 years of the bubonic plague, which killed close to one-third of its inhabitants. With his scientific instincts, Leonardo realized that the plague was spread by unsanitary conditions and that the health of the citizens was related to the health of their city. He did not focus on marginal improvements in engineering and design. Instead, on multiple pages composed in 1487, he proposed a radical concept, one that combined his artistic sensibilities with his visions as an urban engineer, the creation of entirely new, ideal cities planned for health and beauty. The population of Milan would be relocated to 10 new towns designed and built from scratch along the river in order to disperse its great congregation of people, which are packed like goats one behind the other, filling every place with fetid smells and sowing seeds of pestilence and death. He applied the classic analogy between the microcosm of the human body and the macrocosm of the earth. Cities are organisms that breathe and have fluids that circulate and waste that needs to move. He had recently begun studying blood and fluid circulation in the body. Thinking by analogy, he considered what would be the best circulation systems for urban needs, ranging from commerce to waste removal. The glory of Milan was that it had an ample water supply and a long tradition of channeling the flow of mountain streams and melting snows. Leonardo's idea was to combine the streets and canals into a unified circulation system. The utopian city he envisioned would have two levels, an upper level designed for beauty and pedestrian life, and a level hidden below for canals, commerce, sanitation, and sewage. "Let only that which is good-looking be seen on the upper level of the city," he decreed. The wide streets and arcaded walkways on this level would be reserved for pedestrians and be flanked by beautiful homes and gardens. Unlike the cramped streets of Milan, which Leonardo realized led to the spread of disease, the boulevards in the new town would be at least as wide as the height of the houses. To keep these boulevards clean, they would be sloped to the middle to allow rainwater to drain through central slits into a sewer circulation system below. These were not merely general suggestions. Leonardo got very specific. "Each road must be 20 braccia wide and have a half braccia slope from the sides towards the middle," he wrote. "And in the middle, let there be at every braccio an opening, one braccio long and one finger wide, where the rainwater may run off into hollows." A braccio is approximately 2.3 feet. The lower level, beneath the visible surface, would have canals and roads for deliveries, storage areas, alleys for carts, and a sewage system to carry away refuse and fetid substances. Homes would have main entries on the upper level and tradesmen's entrances on the lower level, which would be lit by air shafts and connected to the upper level at each arch by a winding stair. He specified that these stairs should be spiral, both because he loved that form and because he was a fastidious man. Corners provided a place for men to urinate. "The corners of square ones are always fouled," he wrote. "At the first vault, there must be a door entering into public privies." Once again, he delved into the details. "The seat of the latrine should be able to swivel like the turnstile in a convent and return to its initial position by the use of a counterweight. The ceiling should have many holes in it so that one can breathe." As with so many other of Leonardo's visionary designs, he was ahead of what was practical for his time. Ludovico did not adopt his vision of the city, but in this case, Leonardo's proposals were sensible as well as brilliant. If even part of his plan had been implemented, it might have transformed the nature of cities, reduced the onslaught of plagues, and changed history. Chapter 5. Leonardo's notebooks. The collections. As the offspring of a long line of notaries, Leonardo da Vinci had an instinct for keeping records. Jotting down observations, lists, ideas, and sketches came naturally. In the early 1480s, shortly after his arrival in Milan, he began his lifelong practice of keeping notebooks on a regular basis. Some of them began as loose sheets the size of a tabloid newspaper. Others were little volumes bound in leather or vellum, the size of a paperback or even smaller, which he carried around to make field notes. One purpose of these notebooks was to record interesting scenes, especially those involving people and emotions. "As you go about town," he wrote in one of them, "constantly observe, note, and consider the circumstances and behavior of men as they talk and quarrel or laugh or come to blows." For that purpose, he kept a small notebook hanging from his belt. According to the poet Giovanni Battista Giraldi, whose father knew Leonardo, "When Leonardo wished to paint a figure, he first considered what social standing and emotion it was to represent, whether noble or plebeian, joyful or severe, troubled or serene, old or young, irate or quiet, good or evil. And when he had made up his mind, he went to places where he knew that people of that kind assembled and observed their faces, their manners, dresses, and gestures. And when he found what fitted his purpose, he noted it in a little book which he was always carrying in his belt." These little books on his belt, along with the larger sheets in his studio, became repositories for all of his manifold passions and obsessions, many of them sharing a page. As an engineer, he honed his technical skills by drawing mechanisms he encountered or imagined. As an artist, he sketched ideas and made preparatory drawings. As a court impresario, he jotted down designs for costumes, contrivances for moving scenery and stages, fables to be enacted, and witty lines to be performed. Scribbled in the margins were to-do lists, records of expenses, and sketches of people who caught his imagination. Over the years, as his scientific study got more serious, he filled pages with outlines and passages for treatises on topics such as flight, water, anatomy, art, horses, mechanics, and geology. About the only things missing are intimate personal revelations or intimacies. These are not St. Augustine's confessions, but rather the outward-looking enthrallments of a relentlessly curious explorer. In collecting such a medley of ideas, Leonardo was following a practice that had become popular in Renaissance Italy of keeping a commonplace and sketchbook known as a Zibaldone. But in their content, Leonardo's were nothing like the world had ever or has ever seen. His notebooks have been rightly called the most astonishing testament to the powers of human observation and imagination ever set down on paper. The more than 7,200 pages now extant probably represent about one quarter of what Leonardo actually wrote, but that is a higher percentage after 500 years than the percentage of Steve Jobs' emails and digital documents from the 1990s that he and I were able to retrieve. Leonardo's notebooks are nothing less than an astonishing windfall that provides the documentary record of applied creativity. As usual with Leonardo, however, there is an element of mystery involved. He rarely put dates on his pages, and much of their order has been lost. After his death, many of the volumes were disassembled and the interesting pages were sold or reorganized into new codices by various collectors, most notably the sculptor Pompeo Leoni, who was born in 1533. For example, one of the many repackaged collections is the Codex Atlanticus, now in Milan's Biblioteca Ambrosiana, which consists of 2,238 pages assembled by Leoni from different notebooks Leonardo used from the 1480s to 1518. The Codex Arundel, now in the British Library, contains 570 pages of Leonardo's writings from the same long time span and was assembled by an unknown collector in the 17th century. In contrast, the Codex Leicester contains 72 pages, mainly on geology and water studies, that have remained together since Leonardo composed them around 1508 to 1510. It is now owned by Bill Gates. There are 25 codices and manuscript collections of notebook pages in Italy, France, England, Spain, and the United States. Modern scholars, most notably Carlo Pedretti, have tried to determine the order and dates of many of the pages, a task made more difficult because Leonardo sometimes went back to fill in the unused parts of a page or add to an old notebook he had put aside. Early on, Leonardo primarily recorded ideas that he considered useful to his art and engineering. For example, the early notebook known as Paris Manuscript B began around 1487, contains drawings of possible submarines, black-sailed stealth ships, and steam-powered cannons, as well as some architectural designs for churches and ideal cities. Later notebooks show Leonardo pursuing curiosity for its own sake, and that in turn evolved into glimmerings of profound scientific inquiry. He became interested not only in how things work, but why. Because good paper was costly, Leonardo tried to use every edge and corner of most pages, cramming as much as possible on each sheet and jumbling together seemingly random items from diverse fields. Often he would go back to a page, months or even years later, to add another thought, just as he would go back to his painting of St. Jerome and later his other paintings, to refine his work as he evolved and matured. The juxtapositions can seem haphazard, and to some extent they are. We watch his mind and pen leap from an insight about mechanics to a doodle of hair curls and water eddies, to a drawing of a face, to an ingenious contraption, to an anatomical sketch, all accompanied by mirror script notes and musings. But the joy of these juxtapositions is that they allow us to marvel at the beauty of a universal mind as it wanders exuberantly in free-range fashion over the arts and sciences, and by doing so, senses the connections in our cosmos. We can extract from his pages, as he did from nature's, the patterns that underlie things that at first appear disconnected. The beauty of a notebook is that it indulges provisional thoughts, half-finished ideas, unpolished sketches and drafts for treatises not yet refined. That too suited Leonardo's leaps of the imagination, in which brilliance was often unfettered by diligence or discipline. He occasionally declared an intent to organize and refine his notebook jottings into published works, but his failure to do so became a companion to his failure to complete artworks. As he did with many of his paintings, he would hang on to the treatises that he was drafting, occasionally make a few new strokes and refinements, but never see them through to being released to the public as complete. One sheet. One way to appreciate the notebooks is to focus on just one sheet of paper. Let's pick a large one, 12 by 18 inches, that he composed in about 1490, dubbed by Pedretti a theme sheet, because it encompasses so many of Leonardo's interests. See figure 24 in the PDF to follow along. On the center left is a figure Leonardo loved to draw or doodle, a semi-heroic, craggy old man with a long nose and jutting chin. Wearing a toga, he looks both noble and slightly comic. In the list of possessions he had brought to Milan in 1482, Leonardo described one drawing as the head of an old man with an enormous chin, and we will see variations of this craggy character reappearing often in his notebooks. Just below the old man are the trunk and branches of a leafless tree, which blend into his toga and suggest the aorta and arteries of his blood system. Leonardo believed that analogy was a way to appreciate the unity of nature, and among the analogous forms he explored was the branching pattern that could be found in trees, in the arteries of the human body, and in rivers and their tributaries. He studied carefully the rules governing these branching systems, such as how the size of each branch relates to the size of the main trunk, artery, or river. On this notebook sheet, he hints at the similarity of such branching patterns in humans and in plants. Flowing out of the man's back is a geometrical drawing of a conical shape that contains some equilateral triangles. Leonardo was beginning his long attempt to solve the ancient mathematical challenge of squaring the circle. Constructing a square that has the same area as a given circle using only a compass and straight edge. He was not great at algebra or even arithmetic, but he had a feel for how geometry could be used to transform one shape into another while keeping the area constant. Scattered on the sheet are geometrical drawings with shaded portions that have the same area. The conical drawing attached to the man's back resembles a hill. Leonardo has it flow into a sketch of a mountainous landscape. The result is a seamless connection of geometry to nature, and a glimpse into Leonardo's art of spatial thinking. A clear theme emerges as we look at the flow of this part of the drawing from right to left, the direction in which Leonardo drew. The branches of the leafless tree merge into the man's body, then into the conical geometrical pattern, and finally into the mountainous landscape. What Leonardo probably began as four distinct elements ended up woven together in a way that illustrates a fundamental theme in his art and science: the interconnectedness of nature, the unity of its patterns, and the analogy between the workings of the human body and those of the earth. Just below these elements is something simpler to fathom. It's a quick but energetic sketch of his vision for Ludovico Sforza's horse monument. With just a few strokes, he's able to convey motion and vitality. Farther down are two heavy-looking mechanical devices unexplained by any notes, perhaps some system for casting the horse. Barely visible, at the bottom of the right half of the sheet, is a faint little sketch of a walking horse. Next to the centerfold, at the bottom, are two leafy stems, which have such precise botanical detail that they seem to have been drawn from direct observation. Vasari wrote that Leonardo studiously drew plants, and his surviving drawings show how sharp his eye was in observing nature. His botanical correctness is evident in his paintings, most notably the Louvre version of the Virgin of the Rocks. Continuing his theme of merging patterns in nature and geometry, one of the grass shoots, curving from the base of the stems, merges into a perfect semicircle drawn with a compass. On the far right are studies of fluffy cumulus clouds, each with different patterns of light and shading. Below them is a drawing of a column of falling water, stirring up turbulence as it plunges into a placid pool. This was a subject that he would still be drawing at the end of his life. And scattered about on the sheet are doodles of other subjects that he would return to often: a bell tower for a church, curls of hair, shimmering branches of foliage, and a lily emerging from swirls of grass. There is one note on the page that seems disconnected from everything else. It is a recipe for making blonde brown hair dye. To make hair tawny, take nuts and boil them in lye and immerse the comb in it, then comb the hair and let it dry in the sun. This may have been a notation in preparation for a court pageant, but it is more likely, I think, that the recipe is a rare intimate jotting. Leonardo was deep into his 30s by now. Perhaps he was resisting going grey. Chapter 6. Court Entertainer. Plays and Pageants. Leonardo da Vinci's entree into the court of Ludovico Sforza came not as an architect or engineer, but as a producer of pageants. As a spectacle-loving apprentice in Verrocchio's Florence workshop, he had become enthralled by staging fantasies, a talent that also happened to be much in demand in Sforza's Milan court, which thrived on plays and public entertainments. There were many elements, both artistic and technical, involved in producing such festivities, and all of them appealed to Leonardo. Stage designs, costumes, scenery, music, mechanisms, choreography, allegorical allusions, automatons, and gadgets. From our vantage, centuries later, the time and creativity Leonardo applied to such ephemeral affairs seem wasted. There is nothing to show for the dazzling displays except snippets of reports that recount the fleeting moments of splendour. The time he spent could have been more usefully applied, it might seem, to finishing the Adoration of the Magi or St. Jerome. But just as today we love halftime shows and Broadway extravaganzas, fireworks displays and choreographed performances, the events staged by the Sforza court were considered vital, and their producers, including Leonardo, were highly valued. The entertainments were even educational at times, like an ideas festival. There were demonstrations of science, debates over the relative merits of various art forms, and displays of ingenious devices, all of which were a precursor to the public science and edifying discourse that later became popular during the Enlightenment. By calling on historical and religious imagery, these shows served to legitimize Sforza family rule, which is why Ludovico turned them into an industry. Architects, mechanics, musicians, poets, performers, and military engineers were all engaged in executing them. For Leonardo, who thought of himself as a member of all of these categories, it was the perfect way to earn a role in the Sforza court. Ludovico's grander pageants served to amuse and distract not only Milan's populace, but also his young nephew, Gian Galeazzo Sforza, the titular duke until his mysterious death in 1494. Through a combination of feigned solicitousness and intimidation, Ludovico was able to beguile his nephew and induce him to crave his uncle's affection. He encouraged the young man's debauchery, indulged his drinking, and allowed him to preside over the pageants that were performed at court. One festivity Leonardo worked on was the extravaganza that Ludovico orchestrated in 1490 for his nephew's marriage at age 20 to Isabella of Aragon, the Princess of Naples. The centerpiece of the wedding celebration was a performance and feast, filled with sounds and lights and pageantry, of a theatrical extravaganza entitled The Feast of Paradise, which climaxed with a stage piece, The Mask of the Planets. It had a libretto by one of Ludovico's favorite poets, Bernardo Belincioni, who later wrote that the scenery was made with great brilliance and skill by Maestro Leonardo Vinci, the Florentine. Leonardo created panels that depicted inspiring moments of the Sforza family reign, decorated the silk-clad walls of the long hall of the Sforza castle with symbol-laden foliage, and designed the fanciful costumes. The play was an allegorical pageant that began with a masked procession in which the players were introduced and then greeted by a Turkish cavalcade. The bride was serenaded by a procession of actors playing ambassadors from Spain, Poland, Hungary, and other exotic lands, and the appearance of each one became a cause for dancing. The music drowned out most of the whirring of the mechanical devices moving the scenery. At midnight, after much dancing by the players and spectators, the music stopped and the curtain rose on a celestial curved vault that Leonardo had constructed in the shape of a half egg that was gilded with gold on the inside. Torches served as the stars, and in the background the signs of the zodiac were illuminated. Actors portrayed the seven known planets, turning and revolving in the proper orbits. "You will see great things in honor of Isabella and her virtues," an angel announced. In his notebooks, Leonardo recorded the expenses for gold and the glue to affix the gold, and 25 pounds of wax to make the stars. It culminated with gods, led by Jupiter and Apollo, and followed by the graces and virtues, descending from their pedestals to shower verses of praise on the new Duchess. Leonardo's triumph designing the Mask of the Planets brought him a modest amount of fame, more than he had received as a painter of unfinished panels, and certainly more than he had ever earned as a military engineer. It also delighted him. His notebooks show the interest he took in the mechanism of the automated props and scenery changes. The interplay of fantasy and machinery was something he was born to choreograph. Another extravaganza was staged the following year, when Ludovico married the politically connected and culturally savvy Beatrice d'Este, a member of one of Italy's most prominent families. A great jousting tournament was planned, and Leonardo arranged the pageant that accompanied it. He recorded in his notebook visiting the site in order to help some of the footmen, who were going to play the role of primitive savages, try on the loincloths he had designed as their costume. For the pageant, Leonardo again combined his theatrical skills with his love of allegories. First, a wonderful steed appeared, all covered with gold scales, which the artist had coloured like peacock eyes, Ludovico's secretary recorded. Hanging from the warrior's golden helmet was a winged serpent whose tail touched the horse's back. Leonardo described his allegorical intentions in a notebook. Above the helmet, place a half globe, which is to signify our hemisphere. Each ornament belonging to the horse should be of peacock feathers on a gold background to signify the beauty which comes of the grace bestowed on him who is a good servant. The steed was followed by the horde of cavemen and savages. It was typical of Leonardo's desire to indulge in the scary and exotic. He had an affinity for bizarre demons and dragons. Leonardo's technical and artistic talents were again combined in January 1496, when he staged one of the most extravagant plays of the era, a five-act comedy titled La Danae, written by Ludovico's chancellor and court poet Baldassare Taccone. Leonardo's notes included a list of the actors and their scenes, a drawing of the stage set, and mechanical diagrams of the machinery for changing scenery and creating special effects. His floor plan shows two elevation drawings done in perspective, and he made a sketch of one scene that depicts a god sitting in a flaming niche. The play was filled with special effects and mechanical feats that Leonardo designed. Mercury descended from above, using an intricate system of ropes and pulleys. Jupiter was transformed into a rain of gold dust to impregnate Danae, and at one point the sky was lit by an infinite number of lamps like stars. His most complex mechanical designs were of the revolving stages for a theatrical scene that he labelled Pluto's Paradise. A mountain was opened up in halves to display Hades. When Pluto's Paradise is opened, there will be devils who are playing on 12 pots, like openings into hell, creating infernal noises, Leonardo wrote. Here will be death, the furies, ashes, many naked children weeping, living fires made of various colours. Then comes a pithy stage direction. Dances follow. His movable stages included two semicircular amphitheatres that were initially facing each other and closed into a sphere, and then were swung open and rotated so they would be back to back. The mechanical elements of the theatrical events interested Leonardo as much as the artistic ones, and he saw them as connected. He delighted in making ingenious contraptions that would fly, descend, and animate in ways that would excite his audiences. Before he had fully begun his writings on the flight of birds, he made a light sketch in his notebook of a mechanical bird, wings outstretched, attached to a guide string, with the caption, "A bird for a comedy." Leonardo's work producing theatrical pageants was enjoyable and remunerative, but it also served a larger purpose. It required him to execute his fantasies. Unlike paintings, performances had real deadlines. They had to be ready when the curtains parted. He could not cling to them and seek to perfect them indefinitely. Some of the devices that he made, most notably mechanical birds and wings for actors suspended above the stage, spurred him on to more serious scientific studies, including observing birds and envisioning real flying machines. In addition, his love of stage gestures was reflected in his narrative paintings. The time he spent engaged with theatrical amusements stimulated his imagination in both art and engineering. Music. Leonardo had originally come to the Sforza court partly as a musical envoy bearing his own specially designed version of an instrument that was popular among court entertainers. It was a type of lyre to be held like a fiddle, with five strings meant to be played with a bow and two that were to be plucked. "It had a very bizarre and unusual design that he had made with his own hands," Vasari wrote, "mainly out of silver in the shape of a horse skull, made so that the harmony might be fuller and more sonorous in tone." Poets used the lira di braccio as an accompaniment when they sang their verses, and it was featured in paintings of angels by Raphael and others. Leonardo knew how to play the lyre with rare distinction, according to the Anonimo, and also taught lyre playing to Atalante Migliorotti. His repertoire ranged from the classical love poems of Petrarch to witty lyrics he concocted himself, and he won a contest in Florence with one of his performances. The humanist and physician Paolo Giovio, a near contemporary who met Leonardo in Milan, wrote, "He was a connoisseur and marvellous inventor of all beautiful things, especially in the field of stage performances, and sang masterfully to his own accompaniment on the lyre. When he played the lyre with the bow, he miraculously pleased all princes." There are no musical compositions in his notebooks. Rather than reading music or composing lyrics, he improvised when performing at the Sforza court. "Since by nature he possessed a lofty and graceful spirit," Vasari explained, "he sang divinely, improvising his own accompaniment on the lyre." Vasari recounted one special performance that Leonardo gave at the Milan court in 1494, when Ludovico was officially crowned duke after the death of his nephew. "Leonardo, with great fanfare, was brought to the duke to play for him, since the duke had a great liking for the sound of the lyre, and Leonardo brought the instrument which he had built with his own hands. With this, he surpassed all the musicians who came there to play. In addition, he was the best improviser of verses of his time." Leonardo also dreamed up new instruments as part of his role as a producer of pageants. His notebooks are filled with sketches both innovative and fanciful. As usual, his creativity came from his combinatory imagination. After sketching a few conventional instruments on a page, he concocted one that drew together elements from a variety of different animals to make a dragon-like creature. Another page shows a three-string violin-like instrument that had a goat's skull, a bird's beak, and some feathers, with the strings fastened to teeth carved at one end. His musical inventions were the product of both his engineering instincts and his fancy for entertainment. He came up with innovative ways to control the vibrations, and thus the pitch and tones produced by bells, drums, or strings. On one of his notebook pages, for example, he drew a mechanized ringing instrument composed of a stationary metal bell flanked by two hammers and four dampers on levers that could be operated by keys to touch the bell at different places. See figure 25 in the PDF. Leonardo knew that a bell has different areas that, depending on their shape and thickness, produce different tones. By dampening up to four of these in different combinations, he could turn a bell into a keyboard instrument that played a variety of pitches. "When struck by the hammers, there will be a change of tones like in an organ," he wrote. He likewise tried to create instruments based on drums with different pitches. Some of his sketches involve combining drum skins stretched to various levels of tension. In other cases, he proposed ways to use levers and screws to change the tension of the drum skin while it was being played. He also drew a snare drum with a long cylinder that had holes in its side like a flute. "Closing of the various holes while beating the skin results in clear pitch differences," he explained. Another method was simpler. He lashed together 12 kettle drums of different sizes and devised a keyboard that allowed each to be hit with a mechanical hammer. The result was a cross between a drum set and a harpsichord. The most complex of Leonardo's musical instruments, which he drew in many variations on 10 different pages of his notebooks, was the viola organista, a cross between a violin and an organ. Like a violin, its sound was produced by moving a bow back and forth across some strings, but in this case, the bow was moved mechanically. Like an organ, it was played by pressing keys on a keyboard to determine which notes should be produced. In his final and most complex version, a set of wheels turned bowstrings that were looped like the fan belt in a car. Pushing a key would cause one of the violin strings to be pressed down onto one of the looping bows, thus producing the desired tone. Multiple strings could be played at once, creating chords. Unlike with a regular bow, the tone produced by the fan belt could be sustained indefinitely. The viola organista was a brilliant idea that attempted to combine, in a way that is still not done today, the multitude of notes and chords that a keyboard can produce with the timbre or tone colour that comes from a stringed instrument. What started as ways to amuse the Sforza court soon became serious attempts to make better musical instruments. Leonardo's instruments are not merely diverting devices for performing magic tricks, according to Emmanuel Winternitz, a curator of musical instruments at the Metropolitan Museum in New York. Instead, they are systematic efforts by Leonardo to realize some basic aims. These include new ways to use keyboards, play faster, and increase the range of available tones and sounds. In addition to earning him financial stipends and an entree at court, his musical pursuits launched him onto more substantive paths. They lay the ground for his work on the science of percussion, how striking an object can produce vibrations, waves, and reverberations, and exploring the analogy between sound waves and water waves. Allegorical drawings. Ludovico Sforza loved complex coats of arms, clever heraldic displays, and family emblems with metaphorical meanings. He owned ornate helmets and shields adorned with personal symbols, and his courtiers created ingenious designs to exalt his virtues, allude to his triumphs, and play with puns on his name. This led to a series of allegorical drawings made by Leonardo that were intended, I think, to be shown at court, accompanied by his spoken explanations and tales. Some were designed to justify Ludovico's role as de facto ruler and protector of his feckless nephew. In one, the titular young duke is pictured as a cockerel. The word for cockerel, galletto, is a play on the boy's name, Galeazzo, being attacked by a swarm of birds, foxes, and a two-horned fantasy satyr. Protecting him and serving as representations of Ludovico are two beautiful virtues, justice and prudence. Justice holds a brush and a serpent, which were heraldic symbols of the Sforzas, and prudence holds a mirror. Although the allegorical sketches he made while serving Ludovico ostensibly portray the traits of others, a few seem to reveal Leonardo's own inner turmoil. Most notable are the dozen or so drawings depicting envy. "No sooner is virtue born than envy comes into the world to attack it," he wrote on one of them. In his written description of envy, he seems to have confronted her in himself and in his competitors. "Envy should be represented with an obscene gesture of the hand towards heaven," he wrote. "Victory and truth are odious to her. Many thunderbolts should proceed from her to signify her evil speaking. Let her be lean and haggard, because she is in perpetual torment. Make her heart gnawed by a swelling serpent." Leonardo portrayed envy along these lines in several allegorical drawings. He showed her as a wizened hag with sagging breasts on the back of a crawling skeleton, accompanied by the explanation, "Make her ride upon death, because envy never dies." Another drawing on the same page portrays her intertwined with virtue, a serpent springing forth from her tongue, while virtue tries to stab her in the eyes with an olive branch. Not surprisingly, Ludovico is sometimes depicted as her nemesis. He is shown holding out a pair of eyeglasses to unmask her lies as she cowers away from him. Il Moro with spectacles, and envy depicted with false report, Leonardo captioned the drawing.